one of the great secrets to life is our ability to receive and value input. To receive and value input. It's a big deal. It's something that many times people struggle to do for a lot of reasons. Maybe because we're comfortable in our own, you know, our own, I don't know, worldviews or our own, just our own net of how we see things. We don't like to be challenged in anything. It's very comfortable in our echo chambers, very comfortable in how we do things. Maybe it's more personal. We really struggle with correction when correction comes our way. It's interesting, in Proverbs, King Solomon wrote about how that one of the secrets to a wise life and to wisdom and to being reaching our potential is our relationship with correction, how we receive it and how we embrace it. But it's hard for some of us to do, especially not just input, but correction, because maybe our pride gets in the way. You know, we don't want to be told anything. Or maybe our stubbornness, we don't want to be, we just want to do what we want to do or think what we want to think. And so there's lots of reasons why we double down instead of embracing input and embracing correction. And yet, it's our ability to do so that makes a huge difference in our story. We're going to see that again today, a reminder of that again today. Before we do, I want to remind you that we are currently in a little series we're calling Thrones. It's a study together of the we've been going through the Bible for the last about a year and a half, and my notes just didn't open. There they go. For the last year and a half, we've been going through the Bible, starting from the beginning of the Hebrew Scriptures in Genesis, and we made our way into the era of the kings of Israel, where the kingdom was divided into two, and the southern kingdom became known as Judah, and the northern kingdom became known as Israel. And we've been walking through that those two kingdoms, those two divided groups since civil war, and how that the south and the north took different paths from there. And we're currently been talking for the last couple of weeks or so about the seventh king of the north, the seventh king of Israel. His name was Ahab, but Ahab was not a good man. He was not a wholesome man. He was actually the worst king they had had in a series of terrible leaders. He was the worst yet. And Ahab, not only was he a bad guy, but he married a woman whose name was Jezebel. She was the daughter of another king from another country. She brought with her to the northern kingdom. She brought the idolatrous practices of Baal worship and Ashtaroth worship with her, which is a whole different level of vile practice and spiritual degradation. This couple was terrible. They were bad for the nation spiritually. They were bad morally. They were murderers. They killed people along the way who were in their way. And during the time that Ahab and Jezebel reigned up the north, we met a man named Elijah, a prophet that God raised up to try to get the people of the north and get their attention back to the God of the universe, the maker of all things, who had brought them out of slavery in Egypt and brought them to that land. And as he did so, the northern kingdom had drifted under bad leadership. So God was getting their attention through men like Elijah. And Elijah did a lot of good before his ministry was, well, while his ministry was well known, the people responded and said, "The Lord, he is God. Yes, the Lord is God." And the nation enjoyed a revival of sorts. However, King Ahab did not say so. And Queen Jezebel did not come around. They just doubled down, tried to kill Elijah. They killed many, many prophets of God through that time and many other people who stood in their way. They were terrible, a terrible power couple in all the senses of the word. And they, as they reigned, we saw last week a story where the Arameans came down to try to conquer their capital city, to take it from them. And they were probably going to lose, but God had told the king Ahab through a prophet that God was going to deliver them twice from the enemy. Because God wanted Ahab to know there was a God in Israel, God was still trying to reach Ahab, and twice he delivered them from an overwhelming enemy. But both times Ahab just ignored it, did not embrace that grace, but instead he abused that grace. By once he was free from the threat, turned around and did the same to somebody else. He saw a vineyard next to his property that he wanted. He and his wife conspired to have the owner of the property, who would not sell it to them, have the owner executed. and tried, condemned, and executed, stoned to death terribly. And they, when he was killed, they stoned him, they hauled his body away, and dogs came around and licked the blood where his body was stoned at. And then the king, Ahab, and Jezebel, who orchestrated the whole thing, Ahab comes down to claim the property as his own. And this was par for the course. They were terrible humans. And so God sent Elijah to tell Ahab that was it. God has been trying harder than normal to reach you, but you just crossed a big line with this last execution and selfish plunder. And because of it, the prophet said, you're going to die. In fact, the dogs will lick your blood at the very place they licked the blood of Naboth, whom you killed to steal his land. And your wife Jezebel, who helped run the conspiracy, she's going to die too. The dogs are going to eat her as well one day. And your whole family is going to be wiped off the throne. And another family, someone else is going to take over because y'all terrible. You're terrible people. And they were. And that's where we left off last week. And that's where we pick up the story today. And we're going to be spending the entire time today in one chapter. It's 1 Kings chapter 22. So if you want to follow along in your Bible or on your tablet or device, you could do that. As usual, the verses will also be on the screen behind me. 1 Kings 22, let's begin the story today. It says, for 3 years, there was no war between Aram and Israel. Remember, we just saw last week that when the Arameans attacked Israel, those two times they lost somehow. And they were powerful, but they lost those battles. So they've been staying away, licking their wounds for a few years, while the Israelites enjoyed some time of peace from them. But just because Aram was staying away does not mean they were not threatening or powerful. You would not want to attack this mighty nation. They would cause trouble again down the road someday. However, the problem was that not when they came to Israel, they didn't just attack the capital city. They overtook some other cities along the way. And though they had left, they still occupied some of Israel's territory, including the city of Ramoth-Gilead, or the land of Ramoth-Gilead. So, anyhow, we see that there's no war during this time. In verse number 2, it says, then, during the 3rd year, King Jehoshaphat of Judah went to visit King Ahab of Israel. Now, we've not talked about Jehoshaphat yet, but you need to know a little bit today. We're going to get to him in an upcoming week. But you need to know, we met Jehoshaphat's father, King Asa, who was a very good, strong king, although at the end of Asa's life, he kind of went down a bad path spiritually, but was a good king. And Jehoshaphat, he was everything his father was and more. He was one of the best kings Israel ever had up at that point since David and Solomon. I mean, in Judah, he was reigning in Judah, the southern kingdom, and he was a tremendous king. Two things that stood out about Jehoshaphat. One was he was a strong king militarily. The nation was strong. The enemies around them who would attack them were afraid of them. Everyone left them alone because the nation was so strong under Jehoshaphat's rule. But also, Jehoshaphat was a man of great faith. And during his reign, he brought the nation of Judah back towards their faith in God even closer and did a lot of good seeking the Lord. So he's a great guy. We're going to meet him later. But right now, Jehoshaphat's up from the south visiting King Ahab in the north. Why is he doing this? Well, again, we're going to get to this another time in more detail. But the bottom line is he's trying to build an alliance. He's trying to build bridges where they have been broken. Because ever since the kingdom was divided in civil war, ever since that time happened, there has been a bad blood between the north and the south, between the northern kingdoms and the southern kingdom. And so Jehoshaphat realizes, even in his father's day, that that caused trouble. And he's trying to say, listen, we're one nation before. Let's at least get along with each other. So he's up there building relationships. He's being diplomatic, and he's visiting the king. In fact, we're going to find out in a little while that when he comes to visit the king, they're not sitting in the royal palace somewhere behind closed doors. They are out in public having a public meeting with their thrones brought into a public place for folks around to see them together to show the alliance, to show their the diplomatic ties they are making. Kind of like if the president of the United States were to travel to another country to visit the leaders of that land, or if leaders from another country came here to visit ours. that oftentimes the leaders would gather together in front of the press or the people for pictures or maybe to see them sitting down talking. It's to make a show of their coming together. And so Jehoshaphat and Ahab are together up north building this relationship that Jehoshaphat wants to build as a very powerful king and a man of faith down south. Well, it says in verse 3 that during the visit, the king of Israel said to his officials, "Do you realize that the town of Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us, and yet we have done nothing to recapture it from the king of Aram?" Then he turned to Jehoshaphat and asked, "Hey, will you join me in battle to recover Ramoth-Gilead?" Jehoshaphat replied to the king of Israel, "Why, of course, you and I are as one. My troops are your troops, and my horses are your horses." In other words, Jehoshaphat's saying, "Absolutely, I'll join you. Let's do this. I mean, again, we're trying to build an alliance. Let's take back your city. You don't want to just go attack the Arameans. They're still powerful, even though they lost twice against Israel a couple years back. But you don't want to be fussing with them. And attacking the city is poking the hornet's nest. But together with Ahab wanting his city back and Jehoshaphat and the strength of the southern kingdom, we can do it." So Jehoshaphat says, "I'm in. I'm here to help." But then he adds one caveat. He says in verse 5, "Then Jehoshaphat added, but first let's find out what the Lord says." Well, I got news for you. Ahab could care less what the Lord said. I mean, Ahab had no interest. He had no faith. This was not his jam, okay? He's like, "Oh, brother, we're going to pray about it first." Rolls his eyes, you know. Like, find out what the Lord says. I don't care. But here's the problem. Ahab wanted Jehoshaphat's help, and Jehoshaphat wanted to say, "Let's get some spiritual consultation." And you know how it is when you're trying to make a deal with somebody in business or in relationships or whatever you're trying to accomplish. Sometimes you got to give in order to get. You got to compromise or something. And so he thinks, "I want Jehoshaphat to help me take the city back with his forces. I guess I'm going to have to play nice and let's see what God has to say." So in verse 6, it says, "So the king of Israel summoned the prophets, about 400 of them, and asked them, 'Should I go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or should I hold back?' They all replied, 'Yes, go right ahead. The Lord will give the king victory.'" Now, let me just explain this verse for a few minutes. These prophets, at one time, there were no prophets other than prophets of the religion of Baal worship in the northern kingdom. But ever since Elijah kind of brought revival back to the north and the people wanted it, Ahab figured, well, if you can't beat them, join them or at least control them. So he allowed some prophets to exist, but they served at his pleasure. They existed at his grace, probably were on his payroll. They were his people, government-controlled voices to appease the people and their desire for prophets in Israel. And so he summons his men, and he's like, "Guys, I want to go conquer Ramoth-Gilead, so I'm supposed to ask you, will it work or should I not go?" "Oh, king, you want to go to battle?" "Absolutely," because again, he buttered their bread, right? They're going to tell him what he wants to hear. "Oh, absolutely, you should go for it. If the king wants to go to Ramoth-Gilead, the king should do it. We are in your corner too." Enthusiastic thumbs up, because after all, we want him to like us and let us keep existing, and that's what he wants to hear. So tell the main man, tell the boss exactly what he hopes will say. Go for it. Well, unfortunately, Jehoshaphat's not so impressed. In verse 7, "But Jehoshaphat asked, 'Is there not also a prophet of the Lord here?' We should ask him the same question." Ouch. He's like, okay, these guys aren't passing the sniff test. I think they're just saying what they were supposed to say. I think they're saying what you expect them to say. I don't think that this is who we want to hear from. Is there somebody else here who really has a clue or has some truth to share with us, right? Is there a prophet from the Lord here? Let's ask him for some input as well. Well, verse 8, "The king of Israel replied to Jehoshaphat, 'There is one more man who could consult the Lord for us, but I hate him. He never prophesies anything but trouble for me. His name is Micaiah, son of Imlah.'" So this is so Ahab. If you've been with us the last few weeks, you've noticed this. This is so vintage Ahab. Remember, when he wasn't killing the prophets of the Lord back in the day, ever since he's had to kind of coexist with them, he's just not liked them. He would say to Elijah, "You're my enemy," or "You're the one who troubles Israel." And Elijah's like, "No, you're the one troubling Israel." You know, there's always this whiny, "If I can't kill you, I just don't like you." And here he is saying, I hate him. I hate this guy, Micaiah. He never tells me what I want to hear. He never tells me what I want to do. He always says something. He always prophesies trouble for me. Jehoshaphat replied, "That's not the way a king should talk. Let's hear what he has to say." Now, I don't know what Jehoshaphat means, but that's not the way a king should talk. He could mean a couple things. He could mean you sound whiny, which is true. If you met us last week, Ahab did sound whiny sometimes. You know, "I don't like him," you know. But more than likely what Jehoshaphat was saying was this: "Listen, Ahab, that's not a way a king should talk. A king should want to have all the information. A king should want, a ruler, a leader should want to have all the viewpoints, not just an echo chamber, but all the vantage points. You should want to know if there's something that you're missing. You should want to collect all the data. That's not the way a king should talk." So let's hear what he has to say. "So the king of Israel called one of his officials and said, 'Quick, bring Micaiah, son of Imlah.'" Now, again, we go back to the scene. They're not in the royal palace or in a public place. We read about it in verse 10. It says, "King Ahab of Israel, King Jehoshaphat of Judah, dressed in their royal robes, were sitting on thrones at the threshing floor near the gate of Samaria. And all of Ahab's prophets were prophesying there in front of them." All the prophets that Ahab kind of had, you know, they were his men, his prophets, you know, they're all putting on a show. "Yeah, king, we're for you. Go, king, go, go, go." You know, they're all cheering him on. They're making a show in front of him and the other king from the south that's visiting. "Yeah, we're for you. Go for it. God says you'll prosper." You know, they're doing the whole thing. And there's always somebody in a group like that that wants to be the alpha, wants to be the one that stands out above the pack. This year's model was Zedekiah. It says in verse 11, one of them named Zedekiah, son of Kenaana, he made some iron horns and proclaimed, "This is what the Lord says, with these horns you will gore the Arameans to death." That's Zedekiah. He's apparently, again, he wants to be the alpha in the group. He wants to stand. He's like Mr. Visual Aid here. Mr. Visual Aid's got his little arsenal of, "Ooh, the iron horns will help. With these horns, you will gore the Arameans." You know, he's all being dramatic, trying to stand out in the crowd and impress the king. And in verse 12, all the other prophets agreed with him. "Yes," they said, "go up to Ramoth-Gilead and be victorious, for the Lord will give the king victory." Well, about this time, in verse 13, it says, "Meanwhile, the messenger who went to get Micaiah said to him, 'Look, all the other prophets are promising victory for the king. Be sure that you agree with them and that you promise success.'" Like, don't rock the boat. Everyone's telling him to do what he wants to do. Just go with it, man. "But Micaiah replied, 'As surely as the Lord lives, I will say only what the Lord tells me to say.'" That's what's going to go down, okay? Well, he arrives, they usher him into the presence of the kings and the other prophets that are gathered there. In verse 15, when Micaiah arrived before the king, Ahab asked him, "Micaiah, should we go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or should we hold back?" Micaiah replied sarcastically, "Oh yes, go up and be victorious, for the Lord will give the king victory." He's like obviously dripping with sarcasm. He's just like, "Absolutely, you should go. Like everyone else has told you. Don't let me stop you." Well, the king doesn't appreciate the tone, or at least maybe he just knows he's just saying what he wants to hear. So the king replied sharply, "How many times must I demand that you speak only the truth to me when you speak for the Lord?" So he's like, "Okay, you know, I was told to say what you want to hear, and then you got mad at me for saying what you want to hear, so fine, you want the truth, here's the truth." Then Micaiah told him, "In a vision, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep without a shepherd, and the Lord said, 'Their master has been killed, send them home in peace.'" Now, that's often how prophets did. They spoke dramatically, they spoke through visions that God gave them. Like, obviously, the people weren't really literal sheep on a mountain, but it's a picture of sheep on a mountain with no more shepherd, would be like the people, you know, of Israel if their master died. So he's basically saying, you're going to die. And of course, look at Ahab's reaction in verse 18. Didn't I tell you, the king of Israel exclaimed to Jehoshaphat? He never prophesied anything but trouble for me. Poor Micaiah. Can we just sympathize with Micaiah for a minute? He didn't even want to be there. He was minding his own business at home, you know, building Lego sets or whatever they were doing back then. I don't know. He was doing his own thing. And all of a sudden, he gets dragged in front of the king to have an appearance, have an audience. And he's told, say what the king wants to hear. So he does. He gets in trouble for that. Then he says, fine, I'll tell you the truth. He gets in trouble for that. Like, why he can't win. And the reason he can't win, obviously, is because Ahab just doesn't like him, right? Because Ahab, I mean, he represented everything Ahab hated. So he doesn't like him. Oh, you're going to say what I want to hear? I don't want to hear that. Tell me the truth. Oh, yeah, the truth, I don't like that either. You're a jerk. He's in trouble either way. But hey, Micaiah's not one to back down now that the king's mad at him. So he continues in verse 19. Then Micaiah continued, listen to what the Lord says. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with all the armies of heaven around him on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who can entice Ahab to go into battle against Ramoth-Gilead so he can be killed? There were many suggestions, and finally, a spirit approached the Lord and said, I can do it. How will you do this? The Lord asked. And the spirit replied, I will go out and inspire all of Ahab's prophets to speak lies. You will succeed, said the Lord. Go ahead and do it. And Micaiah then says, so you see, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all your prophets, for the Lord has pronounced your doom. That's an interesting, again, he's being dramatic. He's being like a prophet would be, speaking in powerful images through a vision he got. Again, I doubt that was a literal vision in heaven any more than people are literal sheep on the side of a mountain. I don't think in heaven that Micaiah had some kind of glimpse into the exact workings of the other side. More than likely, it was just a vision he was given. I mean, I'm doubting God's up there saying, how do I defeat Ahab? I'm so confused. Oh, there's a good idea. I never thought of that before. I don't think that's a literal rendition. It's a vision, just like the other one was a vision of the sheep on the mountain scattered. It's a vision to make a statement in these two pictures, one that says you're going to die in battle, and number two, all the prophets are lying to you because you need to go die in battle. Well, how do you think the other prophets felt? They're still in the room. Not only are they not getting attention paid to them, but they're getting called out for just agreeing with the king, for just being agreeable. And so as he calls them out, they can't abide this. In fact, the alpha guy, Mr. Zedekiah, he's got to get the attention back on himself. He's going to stand up for his king. So it says in the next verse here that Zedekiah, son of Kenaniah, he walked up to Micaiah and he slapped him across his face. Keep my king's name out of your mouth, he said. No, that's not what he said. Sorry. He slapped him in the face and said, since when did the Spirit of the Lord leave me to speak to you? You know, that's what he said, right? He says, since when? Isn't that arrogant to slap, to physically assault somebody and say, you know, anyone's that arrogant's terrible, but here's a religious person like, God has told me, who do you think you are? And he hits the guy. And Micaiah is so tough. I want to give Micaiah some credit here. He doesn't flinch. Look at what Micaiah says back to him. Verse 25, Micaiah replied, you'll find out soon enough when you're trying to hide in some secret room. Whew. Now, I don't know what happens there because we don't hear the rest of the story. We never hear what happens to Zedekiah. But apparently something's going to go down later on because Micaiah tends to be right. So I don't know what happens to Zedekiah later and what he's referring to when he says this, but I can imagine, can't you, that if the king goes out to battle and gets killed, and everyone's upset the king is dead, and then people are trying to find blame, who do we blame? Where are all those prophets that said the king would survive and the Lord said he should go to battle? And who's going to stand out in that group? Oh, Mr. Visual Aid himself. Oh, you know, they'll be like, oh, that's the guy. Where's Zedekiah at? So Micaiah looks at him and says, you slapped me, huh? You'll find out soon enough, buddy, when you're hiding for your life. And that's all he says. I mean, yikes. Anyhow, the king is done with it. The king is over this conversation. He doesn't even like Micaiah. So in verse 26, arrest him, the king of Israel ordered. Take him back to Amon, the governor of the city, and to my son Joash. Give them this order from the king. Put this man in prison and feed him with nothing but bread and water until I return safely from the battle. Poor Micaiah. He didn't even want to be there. He was playing Call of Duty on his PS4, you know, or whatever. And he was dragged in front of the king. And now he's over here, you know, being told to be agreeable. He gets in trouble for that. He tells the truth. He gets in trouble for that. Now he's in prison with nothing but bread and water, not even an Aurelio's pizza or something. I mean, just nothing. Just lock this man away until I return safely from battle. The implication is this. Ahab is saying, when I come back from battle, I'm going to come to the prison and say, hey, buddy, you were wrong. I'm still alive, and now you're going to die. Micaiah is in all sorts of trouble here for doing nothing but speaking the truth. But he's not one to stop reply. He always has an answer, doesn't he? Look at what Micaiah replies in verse 28. But Micaiah replied, if you return safely, it'll mean the Lord has not spoken through me. Then he added to those standing around, everyone, mark my words. I mean, wow, here's the king. Arrest him and put him in prison until I come back safely. You come back safely, I'm a fraud. Everybody check this out. If he comes back safely, I'm a fraud. Don't listen to me. I deserve what's coming to me. But you ain't coming back. And they take him away. And all the other prophets go their way. Oh, king, don't listen to him. You got it. Go, king, go. I want to pause the story. There's a little more story to read. The conclusion is coming in a minute here. I want to take a couple minutes to step away from the story and just say something to all of us today, that no matter what station of life, whatever age or station of life you are, this is just a good thought. It goes like this. People who don't listen will eventually be surrounded by people who have nothing to say. Right? People who don't listen, I mean, it's so true. I mean, and this is true for any stage of life. When you're a child, maybe you don't have a choice because your parents or your teachers can tell you. You don't have to like it, but what are you going to do? But as you get older, if you become a teenager and you don't want to listen, people just stop trying so hard. When you're a young adult and you could do what you want to do, people just say, you know what, I'm not going to say a word. When you're an older adult, no one can tell you anything because your pride can't handle it. People can't challenge your thinking on an issue or challenge your direction. People just say, I can't say a word to them. Even for parents, if your kids can't come to you and say, hey, can I approach you? You know who I am. I'm in charge around here. Okay, that'll stop. Why try? If your husband can't say something to you as a wife without you going into World War III mode, if your wife can't say something to you as a husband without you blowing up because you just can't stand to be approached, people will just stop approaching you. They're like, okay. It's true in your job. Your employer is going to stop talking to you, and If he can't correct and help you, he's just going to find other people to build a business around besides you. If you are a leader at your job, a foreman, a boss, a business owner, you have people working for you, and they can't give input without you freaking out, without being punished for it or fired or put in the doghouse, they'll just stop. They'll go to someplace else. They'll go to some other company where they have a voice. Because the bottom line is that people who don't listen are eventually surrounded by people with nothing to say. And a lot of people are that way in life. And I don't want to be, let's not be that way. Don't be that way. Ahab was that way. Ahab, I mean, why would anyone around Ahab be incentivized to tell him something he needed to hear when you just watch the other guy get tossed into prison for it? What's the motivation for anyone else to speak up and say something difficult? There's none. So they're all just going to be like, yeah, do what you want, man. Anyhow, let's finish the story. Verse 29, so King Ahab of Israel and King Jehoshaphat of Judah led their armies against Ramoth-Gilead. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, as we go into battle, I will disguise myself so no one will recognize me, but you wear your royal robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and they went into battle. This is hilarious to me. The king of Israel, he's got this master plan. He's like, they think they're going to kill me in battle. I'll just disguise myself. Then they won't know who I am. Well, you might be able to fool the other side, but you can't fool God. But he's gonna game the system, right? He's gonna cheat the system here and disguise himself, because if they're gonna kill the king, they won't know I'm the king. Of course, Jehoshaphat, you stay in the royal robes. Doesn't that put me in harm's way? Yeah, but who cares about you? I'm gonna disguise myself. And so he was gonna go into battle as one of the commanders on the field with armor on, with a chariot driver, and still be in charge, but not on the front lines where you could get in real serious danger, but back a ways ordering some troops, but not looking like the king. And Jehoshaphat could take the heat as the king. Verse 31 says, Meanwhile, the king of Aram had issued these orders to his 32 chariot commanders. He says, attack only the king of Israel, and don't bother with anyone else. No, I don't know why maybe it's because he was mad at Ahab for the last two losses that Aram had against Israel. Ahab kind of mouthed off to him the one time anyhow. Or maybe because he was afraid of messing with Jehoshaphat. Like, leave them alone, just go after the king of Israel. Either way, he gave his guys orders. So when the Aramean chariot commanders saw Jehoshaphat in his royal robes, they went after him. There's the king of Israel, they shouted, which is like, he's in trouble. Old Ahab's over there in disguise. He's like, oh no, Jehoshaphat's getting chased. But when Jehoshaphat called out, the chariot commanders realized he was not the king of Israel, so they stopped chasing him. Whew. But here's where it all comes to. Here's the moment. Are you ready? Verse 34. An Aramean soldier, however, randomly shot an arrow at the Israelite troops and hit the king of Israel between the joints of his armor. Just a regular guy out there fighting the battles, and he's not in the front lines. He's the archery division. He's just firing arrows, trying to hit somebody, which you don't always hit, or hit their armor, just hopefully get a lucky shot. He's just doing his Legolas, you know. He's all firing his arrows, or maybe it's Hawkeye. I don't know which one of you like better. He's out firing his arrows, and out there, he happens to hit somebody. It happens to be the king of Israel, and he happens to get him right where his armor is not protecting his body, and the arrow plunges through. Turn the horses and get me out of here, Ahab groaned to the driver of his chariot. I'm badly wounded. Or in other words, I'm mortally wounded. There's nowhere to go. Verse 35 says, the battle raged all that day, and the king remained propped up in his chariot facing the Arameans. The blood from his wound ran down to the floor of his chariot, and as evening arrived, he died. Just as the sun was setting, the cry ran through his troops, we're done for, run for your lives. Israel lost that day. So the king died, and his body was taken to Samaria and was buried there. Now check this out, folks, check this out. Verse 38. Then his chariot was washed beside the pool of Samaria, and dogs came and licked his blood at the place where the prostitutes bathed, just as the Lord had promised. Huh. That came full circle, didn't it? That came all the way around. And that's it. The rest of the events in Ahab's reign and everything he did, including the story of the ivory palace and the towns he built, are recorded in the book of the history of the kings of Israel. So Ahab died, and his son Ahaziah became the next king. And that's where we'll stop our story for today. Ahab's now gone. Jezebel's still around, but her day's coming. The whole family, who's as terrible as they were, their old day's coming, but we're going to get to that later. We have other places to go. Believe me, the stories don't stop being adventuresome from here. But before we move on today, I just want to end by talking a little bit about Ahab. You see, Ahab had convinced himself that by avoiding the truth, he made himself immune to it. He surrounded himself with people who told him what he wanted to hear and not what he needed to hear. That's so easy for us to do, isn't it? Surround ourselves with people who agree, who feed into our echo chamber, we find ourselves, even if we are out of one, we get sucked into a new one, to get pulled into a place where people are just, affirming only. And we said earlier about about, you know, hearing things we need to hear. Here, let me make something very clear. I understand that not everyone who is disagreeable is helpful. Some people are just contrarians. Can we all agree to that? Some people are just contrarians. They just want to be contrary because that's what they like to be. And a contrarian bent person is no more helpful than an agreeable person who just doesn't want conflict. Both of them are unhealthy in different ways on some level. You know, looking for a contrarian or for agreeable people, you're looking just for honest people. Honestly, for most of us, including almost anybody, most of the time, the good, honest voices in our lives are going to be affirmative. They're going to be like, yeah, because most of the time we're making overall decent decisions. But you need those people who are willing to sit there and say, that's great, I might tweak this one thing, or come up and say, hey, man, don't go down that path. Or watch out, or hey, you should do this. You should step up and do this. And the thing is that it's easy not to have them. Because we surround ourselves with people like Ahab, who told him what he wanted to hear and not what he needed to hear. Yet in the end, though Ahab tried to dodge what was coming his way, the arrow found its mark. I had an old friend in ministry when I was a young pastor. He was a bit older than me in the church, and he used to always say, God doesn't miss what he's aiming at. That's pretty astute observation, right? God doesn't miss what he's aiming at. Elijah sure tried to figure his way around it, but the arrow found its mark. Think about this. Had Ahab listened to all the warnings along the way, this could have ended differently. I don't just mean Micaiah's warning, when Micaiah said to him, don't go to battle or you're going to die. I mean way back when Elijah was out there prophesying, and when the drought came, and the famine and the economic downturn came, when the signs came back from God to get the nation's attention, and the people said, the Lord is God, yes, the Lord is God. Ahab could have said, I'm paying attention now. Along the way, when the Arameans attacked him twice before, and God stepped up and said, look, I'm gonna defend you against all odds because I'm trying to get your attention and show you that I'm here. Ahab could have responded to that grace and embraced it instead of abusing it. All along the way, when he murdered Naboth to take his vineyard and had him stoned to death to steal his land, he had so many chances to heed the warnings. And had he listened to all the warnings along the way, this could have ended differently. After all, a warning shot is better than a kill shot, right? Not that we like the warning shots, but they sure beat the kill shot. I want to give you one statement here in a moment to take home with you. Take a picture of it, write it down, whatever you need to do. It's not deep, it's not complicated, but it's a thought that I want us to chew on and meditate on in our spiritual journey. And it goes like this. It's better to embrace the correction than to endure the consequence. That's just true for all of life. It's better to embrace the correction than to endure the consequence. And it's not always correction. It's just, sometimes it's just input we resist. I always say people are so bad at exploring the frontiers of our ignorance. We just feel very comfortable and safe in this, how we see things, how we do things. We get stuck in our little echo chambers, and our input in general, we struggle with honest input that's challenging. And that's why Solomon in Proverbs said, embrace correction. Especially when it is that personal, when it's correction. And again, because it comes from a good place normally. I know I said earlier, not everyone's, some people are just contrarians, and that's its own beast. That's its own problem. But the truth is that some people, more people than not, are just too agreeable. But we need to be safe people to approach. Are you? In your home, in your marriage, in your family, in your friend circle, in your job, in your leadership, any place? Are we or are we not? Because here's the thing. I believe with all of my heart, that our attitude towards correction is as simple as flipping a switch in our minds. I've said this before. It's like flipping a switch. And I know it seems so complicated, but you can just step back and away from the heat of the moment and just flip a switch. Instead of being prideful and feeling assaulted or defensive, or instead of being stubborn about what you want, just to flip a switch and say, you know what, I appreciate it. And I think there's two secrets to appreciating it, to flipping that switch. One is to realize that most people who bother to say something difficult do it because they love you. Right? Let's be honest, most people don't want to have confrontations. I mean, some people are that ornery, but most people don't enjoy a difficult conversation. where most of us are, we are conflict averse, aren't we? We just would rather just, I don't want to fight. So for someone to step up over all that and say, hey, can I just say something? For us to say, man, that must have been hard for you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Solomon said, whom the Lord loves, he corrects. Look at God's correction and say, God, you must love me enough to think I'm worth correcting. And whom people love, they correct. But what if they're not? What if they don't love me? What if they are just a contrarian? Okay? Even in that case, flip the switch by saying, no matter what someone's motives are, don't we want to get it right? Come on now, folks. Don't we want to be our best self? Don't we want to reach our potential? Don't we want to get the right decision, have the right viewpoint, come to the right conclusions? And we can't do it if we get stuck and closed-minded and only hear what makes us affirm what we want. We got to be challenged in order to expand, to challenge our beliefs, to challenge our behaviors. To say, hey, I'm trying to get to be my best self and live my best life, and I appreciate input. Input does not mean you have to follow it. You don't have to take what someone says and do it. You can sit there and say, thank you, I appreciate you having the courage to talk to me. I'm going to consider it. Maybe I haven't considered it already. Maybe I'm reconsidering. I'm not going to do that. But I want to consider what you're saying. Here's the thing. When we shut people down, when we crush them, when you can fire that employee or doghouse them, when you crush that child from bringing it up to you, or that spouse or that friend circle or that person in your life, and everyone says, whoo, I ain't doing that again. The best thing we could ever do is say, listen, I may or may not listen to what you're, I may not do anything with what you just said, but thank you for at least talking to me. I am open to the conversation. I may or may not be able to do that, or may not be the best thing to do, but I appreciate you caring enough to talk. And that's a flipping of a switch that if we have, I think it change all the, it could change our lives. It could help us reach our full potential, break through the ceiling that holds us down. And doing the opposite can cause us to wreck ourselves sometimes. And as Ahab taught us today, a warning shot's better than a kill shot. And people who don't listen will eventually be surrounded by people who have nothing to say. So for all of us, it's better to embrace the correction than to endure the consequence. Pick up the story next week. Let's pray.